This is Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. The threat of nuclear war today is as real as it's been for decades. Efforts to reduce the global stockpile of nuclear weapons have slowed, despite the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
As we head towards the 50th anniversary of the NPT's signature next year, here is a startling fact. Not a single warhead has been eliminated through a multilateral agreement. Not one. In fact, no multilateral negotiation on nuclear weapons has ever been held under the NPT rubric. And of course, the bilateral US-Russian process has also ground to a halt.
For this reason, 115 countries tried to negotiate a treaty to ban nuclear weapons at a UN conference in March this year. But the nine nuclear-armed states refused to turn up. In a NATO document from last October, the US urged its allies to vote against or boycott the conference. There is deep division in the international community between the countries wanting to ban the bomb and the 40-odd nuclear powers and their allies who have been obstructing these efforts. Australia is one of the allies who didn't attend the conference. Professor Ramesh Thakur is director of the Centre for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament at the ANU. He says Australia is on the wrong side of the nuclear debate. Northeast Asia and India are regarded as a high-risk area for a possible nuclear war. How wise, then, is Australia's position? And what did the conference boycott do to the global disarmament process?
I think we are at an inflection point in nuclear issues in a world in general disarray. One of the many strong headwinds buffeting world affairs is intensifying and multiplying nuclear threats. The current state of nuclear arms control has three distinct storylines. One, there is currently no nuclear arms control negotiations underway between any of the nine countries that possess nuclear weapons. That's China, France, India, Israel, North Korea, Pakistan, Russia, United States. You'll note that in general, when I list the nuclear weapon countries, I do so in alphabetical order. So there is no particular sequence other than that. Second, the NPT has five-year review conferences. The next one in 2020 will mark the 50th anniversary of the treaty entering into force. It is preceded by a series of preparatory committee meetings, PREPCOMs as they're called. The first PREPCOM for this new cycle held its meeting in Vienna in early May. So that's the second storyline in terms of where the NPT stands. Third, the UN-mandated conference met for a little over 3 weeks in two sessions, 27th to 31st March, and then 15th June to 7th July, to negotiate a legally binding instrument to prohibit nuclear weapons. And 122 countries adopted this new treaty on 7th July. That's almost two-thirds of the NPT membership. Please bear that in mind. The NPT number of states parties is 190. You need 128 to make it two-thirds. 122 voted in favor. This is the most significant multilateral development on nuclear arms control since the indefinite extension of the NPT in 1995 and the adoption of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1996. And indeed, I would argue it's actually the most significant development since the NPT itself was adopted in 1968. The treaty bans the acquisition, development, production, manufacture, possession, transfer, receipt, testing, hosting, use, and threat of use of nuclear weapons. So it's pretty comprehensive. The sober reality of the first proposition, no current negotiations between those who have them, has effectively delegitimized the NPT as the dominant normative framework for nuclear arms control. And the third proposition, the UN conference, is the inevitable result of this disillusionment by the majority of the international community. The main impact of the UN nuclear ban treaty will be to reshape the global normative context. The prevailing cluster of laws, norms, rules, practices, and discourse that shape how we think and act in relation to nuclear weapons. Stigmatization implies the illegitimacy of a practice based on the collective moral revulsion of a community. The ban treaty aims to delegitimize and stigmatize the possession, use, and deployment of nuclear weapons, plus the practice of nuclear deterrence, owing to the risks of possession and the humanitarian consequences of any use. In other words, the foreseeable effects of use make the doctrine of deterrence and the possession of nuclear weapons morally unacceptable to the community at large. So the ban treaty's real significance lies in its potential to serve as an alternative normative framework for mobilizing the possessor states to the cause of eventual nuclear disarmament. Going by the experience of the Chemical Weapons Convention, and also a whole number of nuclear weapons that have been so far dismantled and destroyed, the actual decommissioning, dismantlement, and destruction of nuclear weapons in a way that is safe, secure, verified, and irreversible could take anything up to and even more than 2 decades. So you have prohibition, then you have elimination, and then you actually have the destruction process, the 3 distinct things. I want to do 3 things. I'll first sketch the slow but steady erosion of NPT normative authority. I will then discuss the roots of the UN ban treaty in humanitarian principles before assessing the likely normative impact of the ban treaty. The NPT was adopted in 1968, entered into force in 1970. For half a century, it has functioned as the normative sheet anchor of global nuclear orders, from peaceful uses to nuclear safety and security, non-proliferation, and disarmament. There's been, as you know, a global retreat from nuclear power, albeit with China and India as major exceptions, since the Fukushima accident in Japan in 2011. The centerpiece of the global nuclear safety regime is a 1980 convention on the physical protection of nuclear materials and facilities, including the 2005 amendment that entered into force last year. The lead on nuclear security was taken over by the 4 nuclear security summits between 2010 and 2016. The NPT non-proliferation obligations have actually been universalized to all countries other than those that actually possess nuclear weapons. Disarmament efforts had stalled completely by 2017. And so, as we head towards the 50th anniversary of the NPT's signature next year, here is a startling fact. Not a single warhead has been eliminated through a multilateral agreement. Not one. In fact, no multilateral negotiation on nuclear weapons has ever been held under the NPT rubric. And of course, the bilateral US-Russian process has also ground to a halt. It's difficult, therefore, to contest the claim that to all intents and purposes, the NPT's normative authority has been exhausted. And its normative potential has been exhausted. Because things have either been completed or they are completely stalled. Moreover, despite being the most successful arms control agreement in history, over the years, the NPT has built up an accumulating series of anomalies, shortcomings, flaws and gaps between promise and performance. 3 are especially critical and pertinent. First, as the NPT regime is treaty-based, its normative reach does not extend to non-signatories. This has a very interesting paradoxical result that most people don't focus on, and that is the five NPT licit nuclear weapon states have the legal obligation under Article 6 of the NPT to disarm. But the four extra NPT nuclear armed states, that's India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea, have no legal obligation to disarm. The ban treaty brings all the states that possess nuclear weapons after 7th July under one common normative framework of prohibition. Second, the NPT's withdrawal clause reflects the world of the 1960s and 70s, such that although North Korea pulled out of the treaty in 2003, the NPT review conferences have not been able to determine the exact legal status of North Korea vis-a-vis the NPT, and the UN's Office of Disarmament Affairs website still lists North Korea as an NPT state party. Third, and for present purposes most importantly, the strength of the Article 6 obligation to eliminate nuclear arsenals remains contentious. Delivering an advisory opinion on 8th July 1996, the World Court concluded that the threat or use of nuclear weapons would generally be contrary to the rules of international law and in particular humanitarian law. Second, the court significantly altered the nature of disarmament obligations. The treaty specifies the nuclear weapon states and all others must pursue negotiations in good faith. The court held unanimously that they must also not just pursue, but also bring to a conclusion these negotiations. The 14 judges included a judge from every single nuclear weapon state. That was a unanimous obligation. Yet, 21 years later, this is 1996, there are still 15,000 nuclear weapons in the arsenals of nine countries, all of whom are modernizing, upgrading, or expanding nuclear weapon delivery platforms, and some are increasing warhead numbers.
You're listening to Big Ideas on RN with Paul Barclay.
Ramesh Thakur says the boycott by the nine nuclear-armed states and their allies, including Australia, was an open act of defiance and disrespect of a multilateral mandated disarmament process involving two-thirds of the NPT membership.
On the face of it, non-participation also placed them in non-compliance with the Article 6 obligation of all 190 states parties, not just the nuclear weapon states, to pursue and conclude disarmament negotiations. And so many states that have previously championed their disarmament credentials, Australia, Canada, India, Japan, Norway, have been outed instead as part of the problem with their embarrassing decision to boycott the UN conference. Now, as an Australian of Indian origin, I must also note the delicious irony that India's veto of the CTBT in the consensus-based Conference on Disarmament in 1996 was circumvented by Australia's initiative to take it to vote in the UN General Assembly instead. Australia and many who applauded it then are now complaining about the same procedure to overcome a similar frustrating deadlock on nuclear disarmament. In other words, what goes around, etc. The failure to demonstrate continuing tangible progress on nuclear reductions has coincided with heightened anxieties about rising nuclear threats. Geopolitical tensions have risen in Europe, the Middle East, South Asia, and East Asia. Great power tensions make nuclear arms control more difficult, but also more urgent. The nuclear peace has held so far owing as much to good luck as to sound stewardship. It defies all history, logic, and common sense to believe that the most destructive weapons can be restricted to a handful of states. If not abolished, nothing is more certain than that nuclear weapons will proliferate and will be used again. Someday, somewhere, somehow. Remarkably, the romantic dreamers who fantasize about everlasting nuclear peace under a permanent nuclear monopoly call themselves realists. Now, my talk was advertised as an Asia-Pacific perspective. Let me go a little bit into that. Four of the world's nine nuclear weapon possessor countries are in Asia. In fact, only Asia contains states with a full spectrum of nuclear weapon status in relation to the NPT. One NPT licit nuclear weapon state, that's China. Two non-NPT nuclear armed states, India and Pakistan. The world's only NPT de facto state, North Korea. Three umbrella states, Australia, Japan, South Korea. And of course, a vast majority of non-nuclear weapon states who are members in good standing of the NPT. North Korea's unchecked nuclear ambitions could in turn trigger a cascade of proliferation across the entire sub-region, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, with the sole exception of Mongolia, which, like New Zealand, has enshrined its nuclear-free status in national legislation. China is also the sole Asian permanent member of the UN Security Council, which functions as the global enforcement authority in the maintenance of nuclear peace. Now, of course, the P5, being the five NPT nuclear weapon states, is a fatal conflict of interest that mires Security Council non-proliferation enforcement efforts in base hypocrisy. The CTBT, a key barrier to both vertical and horizontal proliferation, has been signed by 183 countries and ratified by 166. This still leaves 8 out of 44 Annex II countries whose ratifications are required to bring it into force. Four of the holdouts are Asian: China, India, Pakistan, North Korea. Since the treaty's adoption in 1996, the handful of nuclear tests have all been in Asia. Plus, of course, you remember the history of previous tests, including in Australia, Marshall Islands, Mururoa, etc. Meanwhile, Pakistan has consistently blocked the adoption of any program of work in the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva on a fissile materials cutoff treaty. Asia is the only continent where nuclear stockpiles are growing, and they're growing in all four Asian nuclear armed states. Asian states hold asymmetric perceptions of the military and political utility of nuclear weapons. China and India have declared no first use policies because they foresee political more than military utility in nuclear weapons. Asia is the scene of simultaneous, long-running and major territorial disputes between nuclear powers. For example, China, India and Pakistan. Simultaneous threat perceptions between three or more nuclear armed states have produced a transformation of the Cold War nuclear dyads into interlinked nuclear chains today. The nuclear relationship between India and Pakistan, for example, is historically, conceptually, politically, strategically, and even operationally deeply intertwined with China as a nuclear power. The resulting greater complexity of deterrence relations means that changes in the nuclear posture of one can generate a cascading effect on several others. The risks of nuclear war have grown with more countries, with weaker command and control systems, in more unstable regions, possessing these deadly weapons. Terrorists wanting them, and vulnerability to human error, system malfunction, and cyber attack. So even though there are far fewer nuclear weapons in the world today than at the height of the Cold War, there is a higher likelihood of their use by design, accident, rogue launch, or system error. Do we really want a nuclear war launched by blips on the radar screen? Do you know how long an Indian leader would have to decide whether to use nuclear weapons as a result of the blips on the radar screen? 4 minutes. In that time, the National Security Advisor has to assess whether this is real or fake, inform the Prime Minister, wherever the Prime Minister might be, convene an emergency meeting of the Nuclear Command Authority, and launch the weapons. 4 minutes, all based on the blips on the radar screen. Asia remains the only site of nuclear weapon use, and Japan the only victim of nuclear weapon use. It also contains two of the least unlikely theaters of the next use of nuclear weapons, on the Indian subcontinent and the Korean Peninsula. Premeditated nuclear strikes seem unlikely pathways to a nuclear exchange. But the toxic cocktail of growing nuclear stockpiles, expanding nuclear platforms, irredentist territorial claims, and out-of-control jihadist groups makes the Indian subcontinent a high-risk region of concern. Even a limited regional nuclear war, in which India and Pakistan used 50 Hiroshima-sized bombs each, could lead to a famine that kills up to 2 billion people worldwide over a decade of lingering nuclear winter effects that destroy crop production and disrupt global food distribution networks. Northeast Asia is the world's most dangerous cockpit for a possible nuclear war that could directly involve 4 nuclear armed states, plus South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. All these developments are very concerning and imply a rejection of the NPT as the globally legitimate framework for regulating nuclear policy, even as dangers have grown and become more acute in this second nuclear age. Now, in retrospect, the present global divide has its roots in the decision taken unanimously at the NPT Review and Extension Conference in 1995 to extend the treaty indefinitely. The price of gaining unanimous support for that extension was a 4-part package. The principles and objectives outlined the goal of 2 further key multilateral agreements, a CTBT and a Fissile Materials Cutoff Treaty. The CTBT, as I've noted, has been signed, but is yet to come into force. An FMCT negotiation has not even begun. Second, the strengthened review process has not quite worked out as envisaged, and the PREPCOM and the review conference procedures have not ushered in more transparency and accountability to close the gap between promise and performance. Third, the resolution on the Middle East called for a conference to be convened, which was reaffirmed by later review conferences, on a Middle East weapon of mass destruction free zone. That conference was never held. Nor have the 13 practical steps from the 2000 and the 22 action items from the 2010 review conferences produced greater results and transparency. So none of the 3 that were part of the price of getting the indefinite extension has been achieved. Unhappiness at the non-implementation of the 1995 package deepens the perceived dissatisfaction with the lopsided history of the fulfillment of the NPT grand bargain between non-proliferation and disarmament. And so I think some states, if not many, have unquestionably come to a buyer's remorse about the indefinite extension, because in doing so, they lost the only leverage they had over the policies of the nuclear weapon states. In the circumstances, one political philosopher based in Texas, of all places, has argued that mass defection from the NPT by non-nuclear weapon states is not only ethically permissible, it may in fact be the only ethically responsible course of action. Now, to be fair, on the other side, the nuclear weapon states insist they have acted in good faith, consistent with the NPT Article 6 disarmament obligation, although not directly under it, through unilateral decisions and bilateral agreements to reduce the numbers of global nuclear warheads by 75% from the Cold War peak. Into this worrying situation step Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. Global public's dislike, distrust, and disrespect President Trump. In a 37-country global survey of 40,000 people published about 10 days ago, only 22% expressed confidence that Trump would do the right thing in international affairs. That number might go down if they see the Chris Ullman video on YouTube. Well, let me put it to you. Let me test you out. How many people in this room are confident that if you said the words NPT, Trump would have any idea what you're talking about? Anyone? Okay, I rest my case. They judged both his policies and character harshly. In the eyes of most, he is, and I quote, arrogant, 75%, intolerant, 65%, and even dangerous, 62%. Only 26% believe he is qualified to be US president. He has sharply concentrated minds on the risks of having the fingers of such an inexperienced person with only a shallow grasp of strategic affairs on the nuclear button. In December last year, the Defense Science Board, which is a Pentagon panel, urged President-elect Trump to consider acquiring a greater number of lower-yield weapons that could provide, quote, a tailored nuclear option for limited use, unquote. In a tweet on 22nd December, Trump promised, quote, to greatly strengthen and expand U.S. nuclear capability. In February, he insisted that the U.S. would stay at the top of the nuclear pack. In other words, Trump has effectively discarded Ronald Reagan's crisp warning that a nuclear war cannot be won and therefore must never be fought. The Trump nuclear effect extends to risks of further proliferation, rising nationalism in the region, territorial disputes in East and South China Seas, continued North Korean nuclear defiance, and concerns about Trump's tweeted perceptions of free-riding allies and relaxed attitude to nuclear weaponization by them have been catalysts for pro-nuclear arguments in Japan and South Korea. Two countries I know very well that I go repeatedly to several times a year. In the last year and this year in particular, this is a topic of conversation in a way that has not been true before. Growing Chinese belligerence and diminished faith in the U.S. security guarantee could also attract interest in Taiwan to the pursuit of an independent deterrent. Meanwhile, there's been talk across the Atlantic of an independent European nuclear deterrent. How serious is that? Germany's parliament commissioned a review, which has just concluded that it would be entirely legal for Germany under the NPT to finance the development of nuclear weapons by France and Britain in return for their protection. Against the twin backdrop of the receding nuclear arms control and disarmament tide and elevated nuclear threat levels, many countries concluded that fresh, out-of-the-box efforts were needed by those who neither possessed nuclear weapons nor depended for their security on the nuclear umbrella of others. The normative prop for the new initiative was humanitarian principles. The catastrophic consequences of any use of nuclear weapons has been a recurring theme in the advocacy of nuclear disarmament since the 1950s. It was also the primary motivation for the challenge to the legality of nuclear weapons mounted in the World Court by the UN General Assembly that led to the advisory opinion in 1996. In the 2012 PREPCOM, 16 countries, keep an eye on the numbers if you can remember them, 2012, 16 countries issued a joint statement on the humanitarian dimension of nuclear disarmament, arguing that, quote, it is essential that the humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons are thoroughly addressed, unquote. On 22nd October 2012 still, a 34-country joint statement argued that the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons concern the community of states as a whole. They must never be used again under any circumstances. The only way to guarantee this is the total, irreversible, and verifiable elimination of nuclear weapons under effective international control, unquote. This was repeated in 2013 and 2014, with supporting countries increasing in numbers to 155. So within 2 years, it goes from 16 to 155. In addition, three conferences were held on the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons in Norway, 2013, Mexico, and Austria, 2014. Attendance rose from 127 in Oslo to 146 in Mexico and 158 in Vienna. At the conclusion of the last Humanitarian Imperative Conference in Vienna on 9th December 2014, the host country unilaterally issued the Austrian pledge. And my computer auto-corrected this to Australian pledge. I wish. That committed it to work with like-minded states to, quote, fill the legal gap for the prohibition and elimination of nuclear weapons, unquote. In addition, 127 countries signed a humanitarian pledge to stigmatize, prohibit, and eliminate nuclear weapons. The new UN ban treaty seeks to give effect to that humanitarian pledge. On 7th December 2015, the General Assembly adopted a resolution calling for work to fill the legal gap for the prohibition and elimination of nuclear weapons. This was reinforced with the Humanitarian Pledge resolution adopted the same day, which established an open-ended working group to meet in three sessions in 2016 and report to the following annual General Assembly session. Crucially, the open-ended working group decided to operate under General Assembly rules that permitted decisions by vote, instead of the decision blocking consensus rule of the Conference on Disarmament. The group presented its findings in August 2016. Our role was to try and sabotage it, by the way, with the core conclusion being a call for the General Assembly to authorize the commencement of negotiations in 2017 of a legally binding instrument to prohibit nuclear weapons, leading to their eventual elimination. This was duly done on 23rd December last year. So where do we stand? The fraying normative consensus around the NPT as the embodiment of the global nuclear order and the framework for setting global nuclear policy directions has been effectively broken by the UN Ban Conference and Treaty.
On RN, you're listening to Big Ideas with Paul Barclay.
With the Geneva-based Conference on Disarmament deadlocked, do we need a new UN treaty to ban the bomb? An Asia-Pacific perspective presented by Professor Ramesh Thakur.
The majority of non-nuclear weapon states switched roles from rule takers to norm setters, reclaimed nuclear agency, hijacked the process from the nuclear weapon states, and were determined to proclaim a more powerful and unambiguous prohibition norm. The Prohibition Treaty marks an important milestone in the long campaign to ban these most indiscriminately inhumane weapons ever invented. It will have a powerful normative impact on both the military utility and political value of nuclear weapons. The nuclear policy goals can be summarized as delegitimize, prohibit, cap, reduce, and eliminate. In this five-part agenda, only those possessing the weapons can undertake the last three tasks, cap, reduce, and eliminate. But the non-nuclear weapon states, who constitute the overwhelming bulk of the international community and the NPT membership, can pursue the first, delegitimization, and second, prohibition goals on their own, both as an affirmation of global norms, standards, which is what non-nuclear weapon states can set, as opposed to actual patterns of behavior, which is the possessor states, and as one of the very few means available to them of exerting pressure on the possessor states to pursue the other three goals. So the goal of the treaty is stigmatize and prohibit. not cap, reduce, eliminate, but as a means to cap, reduce, eliminate. The nuclear discourse of the nuclear weapon states moves easily from the position that the NPT permits them to possess and deploy nuclear weapons to the language of entitlement, legal rights, and enduring legitimacy. They are able to claim legitimacy through the NPT because it allegedly gave legal cover to their possession of nuclear weapons and to no one else until such time as they themselves negotiate the elimination of nuclear stockpiles. But non-nuclear weapon states are the majority stakeholders in the NPT Society of States. And by acting together, they can take back that legitimacy. By changing the prevailing normative structure, the treaty will shift the balance of costs and benefits of possession, deterrence doctrines, and deployment practices, and create a deepening crisis of legitimacy. In this argument, stigmatization and prohibition become the necessary, not sufficient, but necessary precursors to elimination. From this point of view, the treaty will also draw on the long-recognized unique role of the United Nations as the sole custodian and dispenser of collective legitimacy of the international community. So please remember, this is a UN treaty. This is not a bunch of radical states going out on their own. This is actually and officially a UN treaty, and it is a done deal. Just as a nuclear genie cannot be put back in the bottle, the nuclear ban treaty cannot be put back in the bottle either. One common explanation for the non-use of nuclear weapons since 1945 is that the nuclear weapon states fear mutual assured destruction. An alternative explanation is that the normative taboo against the use of nuclear weapons is so strong that on several occasions, those with nuclear weapons have accepted defeat in places like Vietnam and Afghanistan rather than use the bomb to destroy their enemies. But lately, technological developments have begun to blur the dividing line between conventional precision munitions and nuclear weapons. The ban treaty will harden that blurring normative boundary between conventional and nuclear weapons. It also reaffirms, it does not challenge, it reaffirms the global norms of non-proliferation, disarmament, security, and non-use. And thereby, it devalues the currency of nuclear weapons. To conclude then, criticism of the UN ban treaty as ineffective in eliminating warheads, lacking credibility, and impractical is fundamentally misconceived. It confuses the normative impact of a prohibition treaty with the operational results of a full-fledged nuclear weapons convention. The ban treaty is at present the only practical and credible effort to fulfill the dream of a world freed at last of the existence of nuclear weapons that constitute an existential threat to humanity. The international community considers the treaty the only practical way forward for achieving real disarmament in current circumstances. Asia-Pacific countries have been strong supporters. Almost the only opponents are the four nuclear-armed and the three umbrella states. Non-participation has thus put Australia on the wrong side of geography as well as history. If the nuclear weapon states wish to rescue the NPT as the preferred framework and process, it's for them to demonstrate practical outcomes through deeds, not words, by bringing the step-by-step approach to some productive conclusions. A practical agenda for the nuclear armed states would be to extend New START, commence negotiations on further warhead reductions, abandon modernization and upgrade plans, embrace no first use, move to de-alerting, remove tactical nuclear weapons from Europe, universalize the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, ratify the CTBT, ban fissile material projections, etc. So the menu is there. Let them get on with it before they criticize the UN ban treaty as ineffective and impractical. Thank you very much.
Who would like to ask the first question?
Hi, my name's Annette Brownlee. I'm here as one of the organisers from Just Peace and the United Nations Association. I'm just interested to know why you think the Australian government boycotted the negotiations. Is it because we continue to play that deputy sheriff subservient role to the United States, or could it be something along the lines that Australia objected to in the cluster munitions treaty, where it all came down to the transport of nuclear weapons or cluster munitions at the time, or, you know, the whole idea that you might challenge American vessels coming into our ports that have nuclear weapons on board?
I think we do a disservice to our leadership when we believe that they're not capable of making their own egregious mistakes and errors. They don't have to be deputy sheriffs to follow the wrong policy. We know that the Americans put pressure. There was an unclassified NATO document in October last year which asked allies not to support a call for a conference, and if a conference was convened, not to attend it. And certainly our non-attendance is in keeping with that. But I think independently of that, certainly with the present government, the conclusion independently by Australia is that this treaty would be contrary to our national interests in terms of our existing security policies and practices and our commitment to and belief in extended nuclear deterrence. Now, Australia's commitment to that, I think, is not quite as firm as that of Japan and South Korea. So we are sensitive to our other allies in Asia-Pacific in particular, as well as to a lesser extent, I suspect, in Europe. And I think that that is the more likely explanation for why we have voted as we have. Having said that, I think it's worth making a distinction between not signing the treaty, because at the moment the treaty as it states, its prohibitions, would be incompatible with our existing security policies. So I can understand that. But there's a difference between that and not having taken part in the conference itself. I think the second is inexcusable. We, like the Netherlands, should have been there. The Netherlands, in the end, did not vote. The Netherlands is one of the few countries, by the way, that has NATO nuclear weapons on its territory, which are now prohibited. So it could not vote for it. But it participated in the conference throughout. And I think had we participated, we could have helped to strengthen some of the ambiguities and weaknesses of the text, because the countries that typically take the lead in drafting these sorts of technical treaties were absent. We failed to take advantage of the conference to press our point of view, to shape the discussion, and to influence the final text. So I think it's worth making that distinction. I hope in due course we will be able to sign, because the goals and the shared vision are exactly the same between the NPT and the ban treaty, of a world that resists and rejects proliferation and supports non-proliferation, security, and disarmament.
Question to the Professor. Dennis Bright. Dennis Bright's a member of Just Peace. I also write for the Australian Independent Media Network. I would am writing an article on this issue of last week's conference in New York, and I'd very much like to get the directive from NATO to the Allies. How can I find that document?
That's available. I don't know how many articles I've written on this subject over the past 6 months, but if you do a Google of my articles, some of them have the online URL for them. As I said, it was an unclassified document, so that's not a problem.
Since in the defence of something, the West has just exploded the biggest bomb ever, drastically increasing global warming, clearly human-induced, would it not be better instead to look for world peace instead of just simply nuclear disarmament?
That's a question that greatly appeals to the heart of any former senior UN official. Look, we face only two real existential threats in the world today. One is global warming, the other is nuclear weapons. Remarkably, those who reject the science of global warming are derided as denialists, except, of course, in the United States and Australia, where they're known as a government. Those who reject the reality of nuclear threats are praised as realists. As I've tried to argue, It's actually the other way around. It's a dangerous complacency. I think we are at the risk of sleepwalking into a nuclear disaster. And the point to remember about sleepwalking is people who are engaged in walking in the sleep are not aware of it at the time. That bomb was in Afghanistan. More frightening than the actual explosion of the bomb is how it came about. Trump has effectively ceded operational decision-making on these issues to the military. He seems like our own Tony Abbott to be a military groupie. That worries me. It effectively means that if we had had Trump in the White House in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis, General Curtis LeMay would have had his wish, and we would not be here today. So it is a frightening prospect. You may remember, or you may not have seen it, President Trump was engaged in a conversation on one occasion with President Putin, and the subject of New START came up. And he put his conversation on pause while he asked his aide, what's he talking about? So we are living in frightening times. He is a strategically challenged president. He's also impulsive. One of the most potent questions that resonated during the campaign was the comment from Hillary Clinton, a man who can be baited so easily by a tweet, do you trust his fingers on the nuclear button? And the list of occasions on which things have come frighteningly close, it just gets longer the more we know about the Cold War history. So it is a genuinely frightening prospect. Deterrent stability depends on rational decision makers being in office on all sides all the time. With one crazy finger on the nuclear button, we can perhaps survive on the edge of nuclear disaster for some time, if not indefinitely. With two such people now, in Kim and Trump, it's a guarantee that we're going to go over. It's a question of when, where, under what circumstances. I spent a lot of time in New Zealand. I was there through the great anti-nuclear protest movements in the 1980s. Two comments from that. One was, as a man jumps off the 40th floor and passes the 30th story, he's heard to mutter, so far, so good. That's the nuclear peace. The second is, it seems to me that it's time for our Prime Minister and Foreign Minister to start putting some distance publicly between the Trump administration, not the US alliance, the Trump administration, and our automatic commitment to whatever he does. Because otherwise it looks like we are promising to follow him to the end of the earth, and he's going to do his very best to bring it about.
Thanks very much. Ross Gwither, I'm with Just Peace as well. I've got a question.
This is a mafia here.
A question about the anti-ballistic missile treaty. The original treaty, I think, was signed probably in the 1970s.
1972,
and
I think. Yep.
It kept going right until the 2000s. And, of course, I guess the strength of the nuclear disarmament movement was part of the reason why it was kept going until then. It's been abandoned now, and we're seeing the United States now crowing about shooting down missiles with that system that they have in Korea. Do you see any discussion about re-establishing an ABM treaty as a thing to put a halt to the proliferation that it causes?
There's a saying attributed to Mark Twain that God created war so Americans could learn geography. I cannot think in all of human history a hegemon that was more benign than the United States from the end of the Second World War through to the end of the Cold War. It genuinely accepted a fair price to its national interests for the sake of underwriting global peace and prosperity and security, and successfully. I think victory in the Cold War generated an unfortunate triumphalism and exceptionalism. And they began to treat Russia as a defeated enemy and rubbed Russia's noses repeatedly in the dirt of its historic defeat. And so the terms on which Russia understood it had ended the Cold War were ignored, and NATO expanded relentlessly closer and closer to Russia's borders. And all the polls indicate that at the end of the Cold War, Russians were massively pro-West and pro-American. And now they're massively anti-American because they believe their legitimate concerns were ignored. The Americans just ignored the understandings they had given and kept taking whatever they could and punishing Russia. But the result has been you now have a generation of policymakers and opinion elites in Washington, in the Beltway, who have no experience of dealing with Russia with a measure of respect as a great power. Not respect for their values, that's a different issue, but even respecting their interests as a great power. And that translates across into China, because the United States has no experience of dealing with another major power that is a comprehensive national power. The Soviet Union at its most formidable was a one-dimensional superpower with nuclear weapons. China is a comprehensive national power. The United States doesn't have that experience, and it shows. And this is a problem. There was a statement made by Bill Clinton after he left office at a private gathering, which Gareth Evans managed to attend somehow. Gareth can gate crash when he wants to, when he's determined enough. And Gareth has written about this, so I can speak openly about it as well. At which Clinton said in a private address, words that he used were remarkably precise, and right, the pitch was absolutely right. Said, we are the top dog in the world. We can use that position to try and stay top dog forever. Or we can use that position to try and create a world in which we will be comfortable living when we are no longer top dog. The United States is ceasing to be top dog. More than twice as many countries now have China as their biggest trade partner as have the United States. And the United States does not know how to adjust. The greater threat to world peace is from that failure. And a lot of Trump's policies are built on that premise that we can still be number one instead of adjusting to no longer being number one. That is something we in Australia have to recognize and adapt to and tailor our policies accordingly. Doesn't mean we give up on our core values. It does mean we try and protect our values in a world that actually survives and we can live comfortably with and in our neighborhood. I don't see any effort by any of the major parties to engage in this critically serious and urgent policy debate. We are still engaged in name-calling, hurling insults across the floor and across the aisle in Parliament, and pointing fingers and calling shame, shame, shame. It's our future we are talking about. I've had a good life. I don't care when I leave this world. But I do care about the world I will leave behind for my children and grandchildren in Australia, in Asia Pacific, in the world. It's something we have to take back. Too many people are complacent and they think that the nuclear danger is, you know, taken care of at the end of the Cold War. It isn't. It's very real. And I'll finish on this note. Remarkably, of all the countries with nuclear weapons, the most responsible has been China. Its numbers have stayed low in the 200s and 300s, even though its economic situation has changed dramatically since it acquired these numbers. And that's because it doesn't want to engage in that arms race. It's not engaged in anything resembling a sprint to parity. It has its nuclear weapons to prevent nuclear blackmail by others. Those numbers are enough for that. Those numbers will suffice for Russia and America. If they came down from 7,000 each to 300 each, we'd be much happier. You realize 1,800 weapons are held on high alert. Well, that means that Trump can fire off 900 to 1,000 weapons without any control or oversight. You really think that's a safe world? If you are, good luck.
Professor Ramesh Thakur, Director of the Centre for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament at the ANU, with a sobering assessment of the current prospects for nuclear disarmament in the world. That's it for this Big Ideas. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Barclay. Until next time, bye for now. If you've enjoyed this Big Ideas, you'll find more great discussions from Australia and around the world at abc.net.au/rn/bigideas.